guest today is Andrew Screen, who has a new book out about the Nigel Neal anthology series from 1976 called Beasts, which has since developed a cult status. Andrew's book, called The Book of Beasts, is published by Head Press, and I've put a link to that book in the description. Andrew, thank you very much for agreeing to be on this podcast. Do you want to tell us a little bit about why you wrote this book about beasts?
Well, thanks for having me, James. Why did I write this book about beasts? Well, I saw it at a very early age. It's like a gateway program for me to the wider areas of horror. I saw it when it was originally broadcast in 1976. I was 9 years old. Maybe I shouldn't have stayed up that late to watch it, but I was allowed to. And it left an indelible mark on me, especially the episode Baby and the Dummy. They sort of buried into my head, and I couldn't get rid of it. And I became interested in more of Nigel Neal's work. Caught up with Quatermass in the Pit, with one Christmas Day showing of it, Christmas time showing of it. And from there, I developed a love of horror, horror films and television shows. I think it was a prime time in the 70s for this type of material. I wanted to cover a series that had not been explored before. And Beasts was a perfect example of that. It was something that had never been written about for Nigel Neal. It was mainly all Quatermass and his Hammer work that had been explored, but not with Beasts. And the reason for that is they were, compared to BBC, which has a centralised archive for all the production documentation for the television shows, it was different with ITV because it was lots of different franchises around the country. So there was no centralised area to keep all the paperwork. And as the franchises absorbed each other or changed hands, this paperwork became lost. It was only by chance conversation with Andy Murray, the biographer of Neil. He told me that paperwork was still existing on the Isle of Man. So that gave me an impetus with the book. And once I found the files, I realised I could actually write a really interesting book about it.
Before we get into the writing of it and how you were going through the archives and the original shooting scripts and things like that, should we talk a little bit about what Beasts is? So it's 6 episodes plus the pilot, and it's an anthology series of which there were quite a few in the 1970s on British television, and I'm assuming on American television as well, I would think, around the same time.
So Beasts began with an episode of another series called Against the Crowd, which was an anthology series about individuals ranged against the crowd. They had an opinion which was different, or a viewpoint which was different from others. Neil was commissioned by Nicholas Palmer to write this episode of Against the Crowd, and it was the only supernatural flavoured episode of that anthology series. And from there, Neil enjoyed working with Palmer so much that they decided to pitch the idea of an anthology horror series to ATV. 6 episodes were commissioned. More ideas were, of course, thrown into the mix of that. But from all the episodes generated, 6 episodes were commissioned. There's no screening order because all the ITV regions screen them in different sort of running order, and occasionally on different nights. Some are on Friday nights, some are on Saturday nights. The reason why it got to me so much, I guess I was that age where it was something was you know, when you're that age, something sparks your interest, embeds in you. So that might be a love of steam trains, it might be a love of football, something else. So I guess I was the right age for this to come along and tap into something in my subconscious. It's the nature of the stories as well. They were very different from other anthology series at the time. There was more of a there was more layers to them. Even at an early age, I could sort of identify that there's something else going on here. So it's very much a study of man's humanity and inhumanity. So the beasts in Beasts, all the six episodes, the beasts are actually human beings, and that's what got to me really. It was a study of humanity.
So you say that it was different to the other anthologies that were around at the time. It had deeper layers. It had something going on beneath the surface. And but would you say that it was aesthetically different from some of those other anthologies at all, or was there something about the mood or the tone of it? I mean, there's a couple of things that I can pick out that I think are that stood out to me, such as the emphasis on sound. Is really clear in a number of episodes. For a start, the beasts, you don't really see them at all, really, apart from in one or two episodes and briefly. So a lot of it relies on kind of things we can't see. So I wonder whether that was something that had an impact on you.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the prime example of that is during Barty's party, the episode about the rats besieging a couple in their house. And that's built entirely on sound. You don't see any rat whatsoever. It's all conveyed with the sound and how the sound builds as a soundscape to create the tension as things progress through the episode. And it's interesting. The only episode with a soundtrack is Buddy Boy. None of the other episodes have a soundtrack. They just rely purely on the sound effects and the soundscape as it is. There was definitely something about that. With regards to Gene Barty's party, the use of sound in it and the way it's structured and presented. It could be a radio play, it could be a stage play. It works across all media, that particular story. And I think that was something about it that sort of captured my imagination. And it's quite horrific. There are some horrific scenes in it. When the neighbors come back and you think everything's fine, the noise of the rats has stopped. And then the noise comes back, and you start to hear screams from the neighbours, and everything's reflected in the faces of the actors. It's just purely sound which creates that effect, and the actors, being particularly good. That really penetrated with me. Visually, it's very much rooted in those type of productions of the 70s, which were shot on video. So there's kind of a muddy kind of a feeling to the colours and the atmosphere through that use of video. On the location side of stuff, there's no shot on 16 millimeter. Everything was shot on video, so there's no variation in that tone that you used to get with a lot of 70s drama that was shot on 16 millimeter film, and that kind of adds to it as well in a strange way.
Do you know how long the shooting schedule was? How long did they have to film these episodes?
It was done in a traditional method of rehearse for a week and then record on one night. So, for example, going back to Julian Barty's party, that was rehearsed for a week and then recorded over one day, with the main shoot taking place in the evening after they'd done camera rehearsals all day. What's interesting is that all it wasn't commissioned as one series, from what I can tell. There's no production block for the whole series. It looks like it was actually commissioned as a set of single plays and funded that way. So the recording dates spread out quite considerably. June Barty's Party was shot months before any of the other episodes, and I think that was shot as a pilot. So ATV could have a look at it and go, yes, go ahead or not. Baby was only completed 2 weeks before it was shown on television, which is quite interesting. So yeah, it didn't it didn't stick to a particular sort of production block, but it was filmed in that very traditional setup of rehearse for a week and then record over one night.
One thing I've noticed watching it, and you'll know more about this, I'm sure, is it appears to just have one commercial break, and it splits the program into two, which is quite unusual. I would have thought it would have been four commercial breaks rather than or three and into four quarters. But it seems to be clearly part one and part two.
That's more of what it was like in those times. We didn't have as many commercial breaks. We now have four commercial breaks for at least for a program that runs for an hour. Back then, you didn't have as many commercial breaks. Neil, as he goes along, you can see he's learning having to structure his scripts differently because of the commercial breaks. Because he didn't have to look at that with the BBC. So working for ITV, he starts to structure the stories so there's a little bit of a climax just before that half hour break.
In one of the episodes in Baby, it didn't seem to be the part one didn't seem to finish at the kind of 26-minute mark. It finishes further round, so it was kind of it's a lopsided episode in that regard. So did he have a lot of control over when part one could finish and when part two could how long that would last?
I don't know. It's a short answer to that. I think there was a lot more leeway though, where if something needed to be structured in that way, they could have the leeway of having the commercial break later.
Give us some of the names who the big names who appeared in these six episodes, and they all play it straight. They all take it incredibly seriously. That has to be said. Were a lot of these people kind of was this often their first time or one of the early times that they'd been on television, or were a lot of these established actors? I know there's a couple of very established actors that appear
Yeah,
in the episodes, but.
it's quite a mixture. So in Murren, you've got David Simeon, who was becoming a popular sort of comedic guest star actor. He did the first episode of Fawlty Towers. So he was established, and you had Bernard Lee, who was M from the Bond films. During Barty's Party, there's only two characters, and you had the great character actors Anthony Bates, Elizabeth Sellers, who had been going since the 1950s. They knew their craft really well, and that really helps with that episode. Other episodes, again, were that mixture of older, more experienced actors, but you had some up-and-coming actors. So you had Pauline Quirk, fairly who was an experienced child actor. So, but this is one of her first sort of serious roles in Special Offer, as the sort of Carrie-like central figure who has the psychokinetic powers. You had Jane Weimark in Baby. Again, who was the daughter of the famous actor Patrick Weimark. And this was early in her career. I think it was only about the second piece of TV that she'd done. You had Martin Shaw, later of The Professionals and lots of Sunday night BBC sort of stuff. And again, that was fairly early in his career, but he was already established as a theatre actor then. So it was a nice combination of old familiar hands and character actors and dependable newer actors who had cut their teeth on they'd all cut their teeth on stage before doing television. And I mustn't forget Patrick McGee, who is in What Big Eyes, who of course was an extremely established stage actor with all his work with Samuel Beckett and Harold Pinter.
And that episode's got Michael Kitchin in it as well.
Michael Kitchin, yes, of course. Again, quite early in his career, who we now know for Foyle's War and other stuff.
When was Beasts broadcast? Was it after the Watershed? Was it after 9 o'clock? Because particularly in Buddy's Boy, there's some relatively racy scenes, maybe for the time, probably for now. Do you know when, what time it was broadcast?
Yeah, they were broadcast at 9 o'clock. ITV was celebrating an anniversary at the time, and they announced Beasts and the new Avengers as part of this big package of their new season. So you would have the new Avengers before Beasts, and then you'd go straight into Beasts, and then you'd have the evening news. So Beasts was broadcast at 9 o'clock.
That's quite an intense evening's viewing to expect viewers to sit for an hour-long drama followed by another hour-long drama. I wonder whether that would happen on Saturday night or Friday night today.
No, certainly not. The spread of sort of the game show, reality show, light entertainment, talent show, whatever, that wouldn't happen. But back in the 70s, I don't think that was uncommon on either ITV or the BBC.
What was the reaction at the time to this? Because it strikes me, as you said, the new Avengers is first, followed by this. There's a kind of acceptance of this science fiction and horror as a staple part of entertainment rather than cult entertainment. For this to be on Saturday night at 9 o'clock is taking up like real kind of television real estate, and it would presumably get quite big audiences. What was the reaction to it at the time, both critically and commercially?
I've not been able to track down any ratings for Beasts, unfortunately. However, critically, it was received broadly quite positively. Some of the episodes, I think it was Nancy Banks Smith writing for The Guardian, really hated Special Offer because of all the special effects, because it got in the way of the story. That's interesting because that reflects expectations that audiences have of the drama material at the time. They weren't used to stuff with lots of kinetic, in-your-face special effects. So that's quite interesting as one example. I think broadly, what was interesting when I started writing the book, I suddenly realised that loads of people liked the series, often of a similar age to me. So it definitely had an impact culturally amongst the people who caught it when it was first on, of a certain age. And I remember the dummy episode certainly had an impact. We were talking about it in the playground on a Monday morning after the weekend. But yes, it was interesting because it is quite visceral sometimes, especially the ending of something like The Dummy, where a deranged actor in a monster costume has strangled his love rival in quite graphic detail. Going through the scripts, it was interesting. They did hold back in certain areas on the horror. So Neil wrote the ending of The Dummy to include the sound effects of bone snapping when the actor's being strangled. They didn't do that. And at the end of What Big Eyes, there was more movement under the blanket as if he was transforming into a wolf. Again, that was very much cut down and toned down as well. So they were aware you couldn't overstep a certain mark too much, I think, but they certainly didn't hold back at the same time.
I think there's a really interesting moment in your book when you talk about Nigel Neill's reaction to permissiveness in the late 60s and the 1970s, and how he brings that attitude into the episode Buddy Boy. Tell us a little bit about the episode Buddy Boy and what's happening there and how Neil's attitude towards that world.
Okay, so Buddy Boy's it's the most Marmite out of all the episodes, I think. People really don't like it. I was of the same opinion before I started researching it and watched it quite a few times. And it, I now appreciate it a bit more, but it's still an odd episode. Buddy Boy is set in the world of adult cinemas, and Martin Short's character is a purveyor of these goods, and he wants to buy an old swimming dolphinarium and convert it into an adult cinema. And what we discover is that the dolphinarium is actually haunted by the ghost of a dolphin called Buddy Boy. It, not only is it a bizarre ghost to look at, but also the sort of situation that it's set in of adult theatres and pornography. And it's just an interesting area for him to set it in, but he'd already sort of looked at stuff like this as well, and he continued to sort of hint at stuff like this as well. So you had Year of the Sex Olympics in 1968 on BBC, which kind of predicts reality television. That has sexualized entertainment for the masses to keep them subdued and entertained. And again, there was a hint of it even in the later Quatermass, where he had the first episode, they're doing the link up in space, and there's a show called the Bum Bum Titty Show being produced in the studio. And I just, Neil, I think, was very interested, perhaps a little bit concerned about where all these things like the sexualization was going. And in the 70s, especially within mainstream cinema, pornography became mainstream and became mass entertainment almost. And that opened the floodgates for a liberalisation of sexualized scenes and nudity, which eventually trickled down to television as well. And I think Neil was concerned about this, but also fascinated with it at the same time. I'm not sure he was disapproving of the liberalisation of standards, but he was concerned about it, about where it would end up. So I think he used Buddy Boy to sort of talk about this a little bit.
Was the combination of the dolphin with the adult cinemas, was that what makes that the most oddest episode, maybe, or the most uncomfortable episode, or as you say, the one that audiences tended to turn away from?
Well, Buddy Boy was directed by Don Taylor, the same director as June Barty's Party. So I don't think it's anything to do with the way it's directed or acted, but there's something unsavory about it. It's definitely most of the male characters in Beasts are awful examples of human beings. And the main male character played by Martin Short in Buddy Boy is possibly the worst out of all of them. He views things purely in transactional terms about what he can get out of people, you know, and he's a using person. And I think the problem is with Buddy Boy, there's no centralised figure that the audiences can relate to, like there is in Baby, where you can relate to the Jane Weinmark figure. Like there is in June Barty's Party, where you can relate to the couple that are trapped in the house. Special Offer, where you can relate to Pauline Quirk even for what's going on. There's no redeeming characters in that episode. So I think it's very difficult for people to get a handle on it. And then you've got this bizarre animal dolphin haunting, and I do go into the reasons why it possibly was a dolphin, and there are inspirations for that, I believe, and it's just the whole episode is unsavory and difficult to get your head around. But I've watched it several times during the writing of the book, and there's a very M.R. James story in there where there's a curse that is passed on from the previous owners of the Dolphinarium to the new owner, Martin Short, which is quite interesting. But that gets sort of passed over because it gets all the other stuff gets in the way.
Beast is an anthology series, and it seems to me that this was quite a kind of staple product of British television in the 1970s, both for standard kind of play for today, individual standalone plays, and also anthology series like Tales of the Unexpected or The Hammer House of Horror or Hammer House of Mystery and Suspense, which I think came a few years after this. Can you tell us something about the landscape of British television at the time?
Well, yeah, I mean, the anthology series was ubiquitous on 60s and 70s television. Not just anthology horror series, but just anthology drama. And Nicholas Palmer, who was the producer of the series Beasts, was very much involved in anthology series such as Against the Crowd, where Beasts sprang from. You also had very long-running ITV anthology series like Love Story, which was romantic dramas, which Nicholas Palmer was involved with. So it was very much of its time. And anthology horror series have been attempted before on British television. You had Mystery and Imagination in the late 60s and several others. After, there's something about the night, particularly about the mid-1970s, where the floodgates get opened a little bit. And maybe that's because horror anthologies became popular in British films with the Amicus Productions from 72 onwards. And that kind of opened a floodgate. So afterwards, you not only had the Hammer Horror ones, you had several others. There was Supernatural on the BBC in 1977 and lots of others. And what sets Beasts apart, going back a little bit again, is that there's no period pieces in Beasts. They're all present day. Whilst other anthology series, especially Supernatural, it was all period pieces and was something of an essence of Gothic horror.
And we've got maybe a little bit of, you mentioned one of the first answer you gave at the top of this podcast was this idea of you wanted to revisit Beasts because of the nostalgia about it. And I think I'm not an expert on current anthology series, if they exist, but the one that is most popular, I think, on British television at the moment is Inside Number 9, which clearly references Beasts, particularly one episode.
Completely, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. Beasts has inspired this generation of modern creatives. So you've got Andy Nyman, you've got Reese Shearsmith, Mark Gatiss, Steve Pemberton, and they all do reference it. So Andy Nyman, one of the writers of Ghost Stories, the play and the film, there's references to Beasts in there. I think the character of the baby is named after one of the characters in Beasts. Inside Number 9, they did a huge tribute to 70s horror and Beasts with the episode The Ghost of Christmas. And that was really interesting because they went back to the old technology, the old cameras, and filmed it with the old technology. And it was also shot in the same studio, Studio C at Elstree, as episodes of Beasts were.
Why do you think there's not more anthology series now as there were in the 1970s?
Well, it's up. I've talked to Stephen Volk about this. And quite interesting. I mean, he's tried several times to get anthology series off the ground. Tom DeVille, who did Urban Gothic, they all come back with the same reply. The commissioners of these programs tend to think that anthology series don't work. There's also a budgetary thing going on as well, because with an ongoing series, you've got the same set of actors, you've got certain standing sets that you can use or locations you can use. With anthology, it's completely different for every episode. So there's a lot more work and therefore a lot more cost goes into it. So it's more expensive to make anthology series, I think. And I think that's one of the limiting factors for Inside Number 9, why it's only half an hour long. And there's a lot of location work on that. So it's those two factors. The commissioners of programmes are quite reluctant because of costs, and also because they do think there's no audience for them. But the success of Inside Number Nine has kind of disproved that.
Talk a little bit about Nigel Neal. How does Beasts fit in with the history of his work? Is it, you know, in terms of the canon, it very rarely gets mentioned when talking about his most famous pieces. And how did he himself feel about Beasts, and how pleased was he with it? Do you get the sense of
it came at a very interesting juncture for Neil in his career. He'd worked for the BBC since the early 50s, and he'd grown more and more disillusioned with working for them, and lots of projects didn't get off the ground for him. So he wasn't contracted with the BBC, so he just started looking around for work elsewhere. He'd actually worked for ITV in 1964 for a play called The Crunch, but he'd not done anything for them since then. So he was looking for work outside of the BBC, and luckily he got into contact with Nicholas Palmer, and therefore ITV, you know, commissioned him for several series after that, including the final Quatermass, the comedy in quotation marks Kingwig, and stuff like Sharp later on. So it was a turning point for him career-wise. He never really went back to the BBC again, worked for the BBC. He did a few bits and bobs later in his life, like the radio series, the Quatermass memoirs, and the 2005 sort of remake. He was a consultant on that. But he never worked for the BBC really again, like he did do. With regards to Beast fitting in with the rest of his work, Neil started as a short story writer, and Tomasa Cain was his first published book in 1948. So he's kind of returning to his roots almost. And you can see in the collection of Tomasa Cain, there's several stories which would fit very nicely in Beasts. You've got Minook, which is the haunted house story, the poltergeist story, and several others. So really, he's going back to what he'd always done. But it's Quatermass, which is the one that sort of dominates his work. And it's kind of, it's interesting, apart from the version of Woman in Black that he later did for ITV, a stunning version of that story. It's kind of his last sort of horror work for the media. So he wasn't actually very happy with it, I don't think. He felt there's an inherent issue with anthology shows where they're uneven. There's always going to be one story which is more successful and better received than others. And I think Neil felt that was unsatisfying. So that's why they didn't look at doing a further series of Beasts, even though they'd probably generated enough material during the pitching process to look at doing the second series. I don't think it was issues around it being a commercial failure or success. Creatively, they weren't interested because Neil wanted to get a program off the ground called Crow about a slave trader based in the Isle of Man, and that's detailed in the book. And that fell to pieces.
So, when it came to writing the book, tell me about the process of that, because, as I said earlier, it's an extraordinarily deep book, right? We've got something like 400 and something pages. It's not just a critical analysis of the episodes. You mostly, I think, critique and the episodes through looking at the shooting scripts, I think, as well, alongside what we actually see in the actual finished episodes. So can you tell us about how you went about researching it, any journey you went on there, any difficulties, how you brought the project together?
Yeah, the book started about 2018, and At first, I wasn't sure whether I'd get enough material to look at the production detail. So it started more of as a critical guide and looking at the popular culture and folklore that might have fed into the episodes. And then I became aware that there was a set of scripts and production documents preserved on the Isle of Man, and that changed the course of the book. And it became a kind of hybrid between these two things, where you look at the production detail for those people who love that type of stuff. But also, what I've always wanted, and I've always been fascinated about, the mechanism and the engines of the stories, where he got these ideas from. So there was a lot. Once I'd found the documentation, then it became a much bigger in scope book and in page length as well. So I was able to include all that type of stuff. It was a slow process writing it, because I was juggling a full time job and having a family and doing this evenings and weekends on the kitchen table. So that sort of delayed it a little bit. But a lot of people really helped along the way, such as Johnny Maynes, who guided me through getting the book to print, basically. Toby Haydo, Andy Murray, lots of people helped and came up with, oh, well, have you heard about this? So, for example, Buddy Boy again. I was examining that particular episode, and I was struggling with it a little bit because I couldn't quite get a handle on it. And then someone mentioned the London Dolphinarium that existed on Oxford Street in London during the 1970s. I researched that, looked into it, and found that there was a dolphin there called Sunny Boy who died because of maltreatment. And so, therefore, the Dolphinarium eventually closed. And I thought, this is too close. Sunny Boy, Buddy Boy, there's got to be something in this. So it was as these things came up, it was getting them researched and looking into things. And that helped shape the angle I would go at with different episodes. Another one was special offer, a poltergeist in a supermarket. It's often easily dismissed as Carrie in a supermarket, but there's much more to it than that. So in the book, I do look at the correlations between Carrie and special offer and look at the history of poltergeists. And there was one clipping that came to my attention, and there was a haunting in a co-op of a poltergeist in the 60s. So I can't for definite say that Neil was influenced these, you know, took that directly, but I'm sure he would have been aware of all these things, and every writer is influenced by what they're interested in, what they know. And Neil was very much interested in supernatural and paranormal anyway, I think. So yeah, he picked these things up, I think, like a magpie along the way.
Final question, have you got another project that you're working on, or are you is this a complete moment of downtime for you after you've come out of this massive project?
I've actually had, the book, after I finished writing the book, there was a bit of a delay before it got published. So I've actually had withdrawal symptoms, and I've now started work on something else because I've urge to study something and to write about something. So I'm looking at something to do with anthology, horror and television at the moment. And it's how much research I've got, how much I need to do. And they're both massive areas, so it may be that I just concentrate on the television or concentrate on the films. Do I do that globally, or do I do it just for England, British productions? So I'm at that point at the moment where I'm gathering stuff together, and it looks like I'll be concentrating on either films or anthology television made in Britain, and do sort of a critical history of that.
So when that book's out, if I'm still doing the podcast and if I'm still alive, then come back.
If I'm still alive as well.
But we'll talk about that next time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you. Thank you, James. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
That was Andrew Screen, who has written the Book of Beasts, all about Nigel Neill's 1976 cult anthology television series. And that's now available by Head Press. I want to say one more thank you to Andrew for agreeing to do this interview. And thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.